gathered around the fire pit, where Houndy is cooking the lobsters he and Harry somehow got from the sea today. Jessica comes out with pots of melted butter, and Sammy, recently returned from his visit to his father, is playing his guitar in the corner. There are clusters of people everywhere, people playing music and people just talking, and oh, so many people, and Lola is bobbing here and there, putting out platters of things, pouring more wine. There's a keg in the corner, and Harry is pumping it like it's a musical instrument. I am twirling around in the middle of everything, very slowly, very gently, and I am smiling when it happens, smiling as if life is just going to continue in this iridescent way, and I will always be a body, and Houndy will always have a body. And we have time for so many more wakes before the very end comes. But no, there's a sudden commotion next to the fire pit, and at first I think too many people are trying to put too much wood on it. But no, somebody is down on the ground, and others are gathered around, and somebody says, "Quick, call 911. Lola turns to find me, and when our eyes meet, I know the very worst has happened. "Houndy," she mouths to me. And it's true. I push through the crowds, and there he is, my Houndy, lying on the ground on his back, and he is not breathing. And by the time I get there, he is already dead. But no one knows that yet. Only I know it because I see his spirit leaving, and I can see his face growing more gray, the pink of him vanishing like a magician's trick. And somebody pushes me aside and does CPR on him, for the second time, I'm told. And Houndy is gone from his body. But part of him is still there with me. I feel him leaving, feel him slipping away. But first he's drifting around, telling me he loves me. And then soon he's small enough that he can fit in the folds of my shawl, where I will hold on to him forever. People are murmuring. The crowd is like a tide, bending and waving and gathering and subsiding. There are hands on me, people trying to lead me away from him, and good luck to them because I can't be led anywhere. And then there is the sound of a siren and the pounding of boots on the roof, as EMTs come and do their work, bending over him, coaxing him into coming back, trying to use their machines to persuade him. But he's in my shawl, I want to tell them. He's not where they can reach him. Not really. Lola leads me away, but I insist on going in the ambulance. It's too hard, she says, but I am firm about this. I need to go. And she says she'll come too in that case. We have to be there with Houndy, even though it's not Houndy. Not anymore. Houndy, not Houndy. I pass everyone on the way down, take hold of their hands, look deep in their eyes, and see all the love reflected back, all the amazing, smashing love, the universe of stars, the dance of summer. The angel of death, you messed everything up. You came for the wrong person. Somewhere I know a baby must be being born, a life arriving and a life leaving. And I feel both things, the joy of both. Houndy is gazing at me through the mists, Houndy so close he can still reach out and touch me. He's sorry. He's happy, but he's sorry. And me saying, "Don't worry, I'm coming soon. Please wait for me, Houndy, love. Wait, because I'll be there. I promise."
14. Marnie. I text Brian as the ambulance pulls up. "It's okay. It's going to be okay," I hear myself saying. Two EMTs jump out and come inside the building to Natalie, who is now panting with each contraction and swaying on the bench just slightly. Her lips look a little white to me, and sweat is pouring off her forehead, even though she's shivering. It's hard for me to let go of her, but these guys know what they're doing. They squat down next to her and take her pulse and blood pressure and ask a lot of questions. When is the baby due? When did you last eat? What hospital are you using? How far apart are the contractions? When did your water break? And then they put her on a stretcher and take her inside the back of the ambulance, and one EMT slaps an oxygen monitor on her finger, and the other starts an IV. The radio crackles news of other people, but they are intent on Natalie. One of them talks into the handset for a minute, but I can't pay attention to what he's saying. I sit beside her, trying not to freak out in front of her. Also, I'm trying to help her breathe through contractions, which she is not doing such a hot job of. She keeps looking like she's going to pass out.
Okay, Natalie, my name is Joel, and I'm going to help you get your breathing under control,
says one of them, leaning down close to Natalie's face. He is young and ruggedly handsome with kind eyes and large, capable hands.
I think you're hyperventilating, sweetheart. So let's try to slow down your breathing, okay? Take it easy, like this.
He demonstrates how to breathe slowly and deeply, and then gives her a paper bag to put over her mouth.
My wife just had a baby,
he tells me.
Trust me, she's going to be fine.
I'm not, says Natalie. And then she lets out a yell that I haven't heard from her since she got a B- on a research paper in 7th grade, on sea lions, after she had read 4 books about them. I grab her hand, and Joel says to me, pleasantly, as if we're discussing soccer goals,
"Yeah, that was a big one. Okay, Natalie, let's get ready to ride the next one. They're coming about 40 seconds apart now. So just rest for a minute, and okay now, be ready.
Are we going to the hospital? I say to him, and he nods.
Just want to get her stabilized first, he says, holding on to her wrist.
Natalie suddenly makes the most unearthly sound I've ever heard, and I'm stunned when the other EMT guy, Marcus, slams the back door of the ambulance and comes over to us. Joel leaps into action and starts ripping off her pants, which are wet from that water-breaking incident and hard to get off, and Joel motions for me to help him because we seem to be suddenly in a huge hurry. He exchanges a word I can't hear with the other EMT, who takes out a tray of something from a drawer. There are towels and cloths and some silver equipment-looking things. I don't know, but I think we're about to deliver a baby. My sister's eyes are closed, and her face is all scrunched up.
Breathe. Ride the contraction, says Joel. It's fine. You're doing great, Natalie.
Suddenly it hits me that Brian is possibly going to miss his own child's birth unless he gets here fast. I turn to say that to Joel as though there's something he might be able to do, delay things or something. Who knows? But before I can say it, Natalie starts screaming her head off and Joel motions something to me and I suddenly understand that this is it. This is it. There isn't going to be a ride to the hospital. We're going to deliver this baby right now, in the parking lot. Just these two guys and me. Well, mostly the two EMTs. But I am here, too. No one is going to turn to me and say, Miss, could you please get out of here? I don't believe you're authorized for this kind of activity, are you? Did you take the baby delivery test? No? Then I'm sorry. You'll have to leave. And I know nothing about this. In fact, I don't even know what you're supposed to read to get ready for something like this. It's like that dream where you signed up for a course and then forgot about it, so you didn't do any of the required reading, and now you've realized your mistake, but it's too late to withdraw. My sister says. I take her hand. And when I look down, I see that there is the top of the baby's head, like, coming out of her.
Crowning? She's crowning, Joel says. Amazing, isn't it?
My sister's face is all red and contorted, and her eyes are squinched closed. I am thinking a ridiculous thought, that she is not going to like the fact that she didn't get to have the birth plan she wanted. She was so emphatic about the whole thing. Natalie is swamped by another contraction, and she yells and grabs my hand and grips it so hard that I'm halfway certain that my fingers are going to turn black and fall off by Wednesday. Joel instructs her on one final push.
Give me a good one, a nice steady push.
And then, my God, somehow a tiny human, gray and mottled and covered in what looks like cottage cheese, comes sliding out, guided by Joel's gloved, capable hands. A baby! Oh my God, there's a baby girl! With eyes open, looking around! And little fists curled up tight, legs folded in so compactly, now stretching out, kicking, yelling, breathing like a champ. Joel is holding her in the crook of his arm. I look up at Natalie and her eyes are bright with tears and my face is streaming wetness. My heart is galloping all around and my hands look like they might soon start bleeding from the little half moons of Natalie's nails pressing into them.
Good job, says Joel softly,
and Marcus smiles and rips off his gloves. Both of them are so calm and methodical. It's like they're injecting calm into the air, like pure love. I hear that voice again.
You are love. You are going to be all right.
And my niece, Amelia Jane, is now looking around with wide navy blue eyes, making little peeps of protest, her tiny body turning pinker by the second, as though she's under some kind of cosmic light. She has a fringe of dark hair and little arms and legs and fingers and thumbs, all of your most important equipment. And she's alert and aware. Her filmy eyes lock onto mine, and I'm smitten, stunned, thinking, how can this be? How does such a thing happen around us every day, and we just go about our lives like it's nothing out of the ordinary? The two guys are busy doing official medical stuff, cleaning Natalie, covering her up. Joel hands the baby to me, which makes me startle. Me? Are you serious? I look around, venture out of my trance. Wow, we're in an ambulance, sitting in the parking area of the dentist's office. Outside, there are cars honking, voices of people walking past the ambulance, unaware. Somewhere out there is Jeremy. Did he go back upstairs to help somebody with a backache? But here, in this cocoon, plopped into my arms in a little blanket, is my niece, round and rosy and just as startled as I am. Here, let me give her to her mom, I say. Natalie is propped up now, the stunned look gone from her features. She takes the baby from me, and our eyes meet. Joel says,
Beautiful baby. You did a great job. Boy, these are my favorite kinds of days, when I get to help a baby come into the world.
After a bit, I'm aware that the ambulance is moving. Marcus is taking us to the hospital. But slowly, no sirens. Our own little traveling safe place is moving, taking with us all the equipment we could ever need.
Look what we did,
Natalie says, and her eyes are locked onto mine.
You are the best sister in the world. How did you know to be here, that I needed you?
We both gaze down at this little life we just brought into the world. My heart is so full, it feels like it will spill out of me somehow.
You know, of all our antics, I have to say that this is the best sister act we've ever pulled off, I tell her, even though it wasn't the birth plan you had in mind.
Yeah, she says,
but only because I didn't think I could get this one to work. I think I might just die of this. That evening, the whole family comes to my sister's hospital room, where she presides beautifully, wearing a lovely peach-colored nightgown I fetched for her from the gift shop, and her hair is clean and shining. She is even more radiant than ever, with her skin looking dewy and lit from within. And little Amelia, rosy little Amelia, lies contented in her mother's arms, pooching out her sweet pink little lips. Joel, the delicious EMT, shows up at one point with a bouquet of flowers, and my whole family goes gaga over him. He explains that he hardly ever gets to deliver babies, and that he was, in fact, a mess when his own wife went into labor. And that makes everybody laugh, and my mother wants to invite him and his entire family over for dinner, except that my father quietly puts his hand on her arm before she can quite squeak out the invitation. Brian, sitting on my sister's side, is clearly smitten with the whole scene. I was a little worried that he was going to feel he'd been cut out of the deal somehow, but he doesn't seem to mind in the least. Here he got a perfect baby girl without having to even endure one of my sister's high-pitched screams. Screams that will never, ever be mentioned by anyone, though they are going to live on in some pocket of my memory until the end of time. "She looks like your brother," says my mother to my father.
"Joe? I think you're just saying that because he's bald."
"No, look at the chin. It's Joe's chin."
"But that's just because he had his teeth knocked out playing street hockey. People with no teeth, like Amelia for now, have those kinds of chins."
To my surprise, my mother laughs, and my father tucks his head over her shoulder, and for a moment they're both smiling down at the baby. It seems impossible to believe that this is a couple who communicates mainly through bickering. Maybe, it occurs to me, this is what marriage ultimately turns into. You have to tough it out through the bad times so that you can get to these pinnacle moments when life has just handed you a shiny star. I'm not even surprised when Jeremy shows up, carrying balloons, or when my parents greet him like the long-lost son they never had. Nor is it shocking that he and I leave the hospital together, going out for dinner, and that after that we go to his mother's house and sit on the screened porch where we spent thousands of hours doing homework and gossiping about other kids. He's grown up to be a good-natured, good-looking man who takes care of his mom, and I'm suddenly so sorry I broke his heart, except that I think that we all do need to have our hearts broken at some point. And so maybe I actually did him a good service. It's something we need to know about ourselves, how that heart breaks and grows back. My own heart, given away to Noah, now stirs somewhere deep down, stretches, yawns, looks at its watch, and rolls over, tries to go back to sleep. But it has one eye open, I notice. In no time, over a glass of wine, we've covered our college years and our employment decisions. His good, mine questionable. And then, because this is what you do under these circumstances, we rehash our own breakup, casting it in a new, more philosophical, forgiving light. After he razzes me for falling for Brad Whitaker, I say to him, "Did you ever think that maybe you could have tried harder to fight for me? Like, you at least could have said you cared about me? Maybe asked me not to date him?"
"I was not equipped at 17 to have that kind of conversation," he says.
"Yeah, well, you treated me like I was just one of your buddies, and I honestly had no idea you cared one way or the other." He smiles, and his eyes hold mine a lot longer than necessary.
"Didn't you? Really?"
he says.
"Yeah, I know I wasn't any Prince Charming, more's the pity. But on the other hand, I'm the one who gets to sit here with you tonight, while he's some loser out in the world not spending time with you. So, maybe the good guy triumphs in the end, you know?"
He is gazing at me so directly that I have to look away. Then he says,
I've, heard through the grapevine that you've had something of a rough go. We don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, but...
Oh, I say. Well, yeah. Pretty much your average stood up at the altar situation. Not really ideal.
Well, that certainly sucks.
He looks at me like he wants to hear what happened, and not just so he can gloat a little bit over my poor judgment. So I go through the story, the long version, including the 2 years Noah and I were together, the engagement excitement, and then him showing up late to the wedding, and our horrible talk in the meadow, blah, blah, blah. And then I tell him about the honeymoon and the screaming monkeys, because by now it's becoming the story I tell about my marriage, and it always gets a laugh, as well as a sympathetic clucking, depending on how I tell it. With him, I confess the part I hadn't told anyone but Natalie, how I dismantled my wedding dress, because he is the only person who would understand something that bizarre and find it funny. Sure enough, he laughs in all the right places. And he does this thing that I now remember he used to do as a kid. He sort of wrinkles his nose and closes his eyes before he laughs. It's just a little quirk, but seeing him do it still makes my heart glad. And then things shift slightly. Jeremy is looking at me without having to look away. He says that this is a momentous day, because not only have we been present at the miracle of birth, but he's also gotten to hear about a jerk who is perhaps even worse than the jerk I ditched him for senior year. When he comes over to the couch where I'm sitting and puts his hand idly on my arm, I slide over closer, and it turns out that, thank God, he's learned something about kissing in the intervening years, because I realize that I haven't been kissed in quite a while, and I need it badly. It's still a slightly cautious kiss around the edges, of course, because it's Jeremy, and also because I have hurt him before, and so maybe he's wisely holding something back. But I throw myself into it, kissing him as passionately as I can, holding nothing back, just to show him how it can be done. And then, my God, in no time at all, we're breathless and shocked at the heat we've generated. He looks at me in surprise, and I see his Adam's apple bob up and down. He smells like aftershave, and my mind briefly wobbles, goes to the back seats of cars in high school, to the hot breath of boys and their heavy aroma of sex. Was it Old Spice? Something else?
So, listen, he says roughly. Will you, I mean, I know it's weird with my mother upstairs sleeping, but we used to be good at sneaking around and...
Yes, I say. I will.
He pulls away, wide-eyed. Yeah? Really?
He blinks, and I think maybe he'll lose his nerve. But then he says,
okay then. Okay. Let's do it.
And he takes me upstairs to his boyhood room, and I swear it's like time has stood still up there, with his single bed still in there, and his old posters of Harry Potter.
Dude, your room, I say. My God, everything's still the same except the Star Wars sheets. How in the world have you not changed anything?
He looks around like he's seeing it all for the first time, too, and runs his fingers through his hair.
I'm hopeless, I know. I guess I was thinking I'd move out sometime, so why get new stuff?
He looks very concerned.
It is weird in here, isn't it? The question is it too weird for you? Deal-breakingly weird? Are we going to have to go to Kmart before we can make anything happen between us, do you think?
No, I say. No, but seriously, Harry Potter...
Everybody knows that Harry Potter is cool, and besides,
he wraps his arms around me and puts his face up against mine, whispering,
full disclosure, the Star Wars sheets are in the wash. They'll be back on the bed next time you're here.
I'm laughing as I wrap my arms around his neck. Well, I can certainly see that you don't bring a lot of women home.
He gets all serious. No, well, I guess I don't. My mom being here and all.
He starts planting little kisses all along my jawline, down to my neck. With his right hand, he unbuttons my blouse.
And can you please, could we both stop laughing so we can have sex? Am I going to have to go get a paper bag for you to breathe into? Because hysterical laughter really ruins a seduction scene.
Oh, brother, is this a seduction scene?
Well, I'm trying, he says, and he reaches around to unfasten my bra,
and I attempt to be serious, which makes me start laughing all over again.
Could you? He says. Stop!
He walks me backward, over to his bed, and we fall down on the mattress, with him on top of me, and he says,
I can't believe how long I've waited for this.
And I say, me too,
as you do.
It's just the slightest bit awkward, but I'm wondering if life would have been altogether different if we had done this long, long ago, that day way back when he didn't buy condoms. If I could go back in time, I'd insist we try another drugstore. This is what I'm thinking, lying there underneath him and looking into his eyes. And then, all of a sudden, I'm not thinking anymore at all. Sex has a way of taking over, all the body parts waking right up and taking their stations. Afterward, I think how nice it is, lying there in his arms, as though no time at all has gone by. Press a button, and bingo, you're back to safety. When I go home that evening, I realize that I, too, am sleeping in my girlhood room with the same posters and sheets. We're not so different after all, he and I. The walking wounded, coming home to heal.
15. Blix. So I don't die. I don't die that night, and I don't die the next week or the next after that. In fact, I have never had a larger appetite or more of a piercing sense of what it means to be alive. All this feels like bonus time, like the days that get tacked on to a vacation trip because the airline cancels your flight. There's a kind of holiness to these days, this time, painful as it is. Maybe I am meant to simply cruise along. Maybe there's still something I am supposed to accomplish. Or maybe when death came for me, Houndy jumped out in front and took his turn first. He's a scoundrel, that one. Ah, well, but if you believe as I do that there are no mistakes, then clearly I am supposed to be here. Summer ends, and Brooklyn ushers in September. I am tired. The mad current of life goes on around me. A bright ribbon of humanity exists outside, coming back to life now that the summer's heat has dissipated some. There is laughter, and there are doors slamming, and sirens, and cars backfiring, and conversations and arguments in the street and out the windows. Houndy's chrysanthemums bloom in his rooftop pots, as though he's saying hi. The nights grow chilly, and Sammy goes back to school and doesn't come home now until after 6 o'clock every day because he's in an after-school program. Patrick is still writing about diseases, but he comes up to see me sometimes when he knows no one else will be here. In this bonus time I've been given, I trundle down the steps, bringing him cakes and pickles and delicate mushrooms, and once a Prosecco that I need him to taste. But no matter how often I throw open his curtains and rub his head, no matter how many times I hug him and bask in his presence, I'm not sure anything I've said has yet convinced Patrick that he deserves love. Sometimes the universe has its own ideas, and I have to accept the fact that I may run out of time here on the planet, and I have to hope I can watch people from the unseen realm. I wonder if that's true, if I'll see them and hear them, if I'll be able to communicate from beyond. I take a deep, deep breath, breathing in the city around me, all its sounds and voices, and the car horns, and the laughter and uncertainty of life on planet Earth. And then a voice says to me, "There is nothing more important than this." One morning I make my way out to the stoop. I have sciatica. I have a pain in my chest area, an arm that feels on fire, and my eyes are burning. I haven't been able to sleep since 4 o'clock, that blackest of hours. So at first light I go outside where I can watch street life happening in front of me, and perhaps be healed by the jangle of personalities and car horns. I want to stop thinking of pain as a problem I have to solve. I'm sitting there on my blue flowered pillow, thinking about endings, when I notice a man loping down the sidewalk. He is swinging a backpack behind him, and I watch him come toward me because it is more effort to turn away, frankly, and because I have a little tingly sense that something is about to happen. He looks elegant and disheveled at the same time, animal-like in the way he moves, his arms swinging and his long legs in their khaki shorts striding down the street, looking around him the way a tourist would. He comes closer and closer, until I finally have to put my hand over my mouth, seeing who it is. "Noah," I say, and I cannot even stand up, cannot hold on even another hour, because I am suddenly so tired, and here is Noah to catch me when I fall. Maybe he is the miracle I've been waiting for, the Savior coming to console me, to pay his respects, to say goodbye. Wouldn't it be amazing if, after all our family history, the universe has sent him, and he turns out to be the one who helps me? He comes closer, peering at me from under a fringe of long hair, and I don't see very well, but I feel his shock at the look of me. All that terror. "Aunt Blix, what happened to you?" he says. "Look at you. What, are you ill?" "Yes," I say. "I'm actually about to drop dead. That's why you're here." "That's why I'm here?" he says. He doesn't hug me. He runs his hands through his mop of hair and looks around. "You're dying?" he says. He licks his lips nervously. "Shouldn't you be in the hospital? Who's taking care of you?" He looks up and down the street, like he's hoping a team of doctors and medical professionals with their stethoscopes will step out from behind the shrubbery and tell him everything is under control. I almost want to laugh. "No, honey, there's no need for hospitals. I'm dying," I say. "Perfectly normal thing to do at the end of life. Come and sit with me. I'm so glad to see you." "Aunt Blix, I think we need to get you to a doctor." "The hell? No doctors, darling. But doctors could help you. I've been dying for some time now, and I have no intention of seeing doctors now. Sit here, please. Hold my hand." He looks so sad, so frightened, like if he could, he'd rewind the tape, spool himself walking backward down the street, back down the subway steps, back into the subway car, perhaps all the way back to the airport, and maybe even back to Africa, the plane flying in reverse. But he sits, perched on the steps, and I take his hand in mine, and he lets me hold it there. I flow in abundance of love and energy to him. Ah, my grandnephew, how we loved each other when he was a little kid. But as can so easily happen with distance and time, things went bad between us later. I remember that he came to visit Houndy and me when he was about 19 and full of himself. I was shocked at the change in him. He was so much his mother's son at that point, arrogant and judgmental, challenging me about all my beliefs, laughing at us for being old hippies, as he called us. Even worse, I felt the first inklings of a brittle vanity in him, as though appearances were all that mattered, in the same way Wendy was renovating our old mansion without curiosity for the past or any attention to the details that made the old house beautiful. Just pave over what you don't appreciate. That's what my family seems to say. And mock in others whatever you yourself don't understand. But now maybe we have another chance. Clearly that's what his presence here means. Well then, what? He says, what can I do? You can ease me over to the other side, I say. That's what I'm hoping you'll do. Wait, does my mom know how sick you are? No. Nobody in the family knows. That's the way I wanted it. But now you're going to be here, and I hope you're going to stay with me while it happens. And it's going to be the kindest thing you could ever do for me. I can't, I don't.
Shh.
Yes, you can. Everything is going to be fine, I tell him. Whether you know it or not, you were sent here. And now that you're here, you can stay with me while I go. It might take a few days, but it's coming soon. And, sweetheart, this is going to be good for you. Something elemental about life that you need to know. His beautiful face looks so uncertain. I almost want to reach over and pinch his cheeks between my fingers like I did when he was small. But when? He says. I mean, what's going to happen? Well, that's what we don't know. I thought it would be by now, but it hasn't. I think I must have been waiting for you. The universe has sent you. His shoulders slump. I close my eyes and surround him in white light so that I can forgive him for being his mother's son. He's a child, a novice, what J.K. Rowling would label a muggle. Unsuitable for the task at hand, but maybe he'll get there. Here, let's begin with this. Walk me inside the house, I say. Okay. He says, and manages to support my arm as we slowly walk up the stairs. It's funny how I'd come down these steps all alone, slowly but still. But now I have to lean on him to get back up. I stop when I need to, which is about a million times because this may be my last look at this beautiful scene, at my life here that I have loved with all my heart. Do you think you're going to suffer? He says. Oh, my darling, I have decided not to suffer, I tell him. Suffering is optional. We get to the top of the steps, and he opens the big wooden door. I see our reflection briefly in the pane of glass as it catches us in the sunlight when it swings open. The smells of breakfast, of the parquet floors, the curtains blowing, the wind chimes tinkle above us, a comfort. It's really going to be all right, I tell him. I'm not scared, and I don't want you to be scared either.
16. Marnie. Summer has turned to September, which in Jacksonville means it's summer 2.0. The days are still bright and hot. The nights are filled with the electric sounds of buzzing insects and flashes of heat lightning. The air is still as humid as the inside of a dog's mouth. And, yes, I'm still living with my parents and hanging out with Natalie and Brian and the baby. And now there's Jeremy. We go running on the beach. We play cards with my parents. We cruise around in his car like we did in high school. It's like when we were teenagers, except for the stunning fact that we're adults, so we also have sex now. There's something so sweet and uncomplicated about these days, being with a guy who speaks your same language, who knows all the old jokes, who loved you even when you had braces and hair tinted green from chlorine. We know the smell of each other's houses, which cabinet holds the drinking glasses, and which drawer has the flatware. He already likes my family. I already like his mom. Sometimes these days it's already noon before I think of Noah. Another good thing is that Jeremy has asked me to work with him in his office, which has happily put aside forever the talk of me having to be a dining room manager at the Crab and Clam House. So, now 3 days a week, the days I'm not helping Natalie with the baby, I put on a skirt and blouse and little heels and go play receptionist, sitting there in his tastefully appointed office, talking on the telephone and ushering in his patients. His patients tell me they all love him because apparently he's simply magic with his hands, as one woman put it. He makes back pain and knee pain vanish. I felt a little pang of jealousy when she said that, which for me is a sure sign that I'm falling for him. After all, he's in that exam room looking at women's bodies, and not only that, thinking about how their muscles and tendons could be made to feel better. And I get to be the one he sleeps with. I feel a little bit of a thrill when I see him do all the things he used to do. The way he flips his hair out of his eyes, that nose wrinkling thing, and how sometimes he rubs his hands together when he's anticipating something wonderful. He has never really appreciated deep, long kisses, but he's the master of divine mini kisses all along my jawline, a whole trail of kisses. What can I say? I know it's way too soon to make any huge pronouncements. I'm not crazy or anything. But, as Natalie keeps pointing out to me, he and I seem more and more like a couple every single day. And she ought to know. We visit her and Brian in the evenings after work, and we've become a lovely foursome. Two ordinary happy couples in the family room, with the guys making sports conversation, and Natalie and I sitting with them, cuddling the baby. The four of us pass the baby around like she's a big platter of happiness we all share. I tell you, it's as though I've walked through a door called normalcy, the door I was always trying to find. Most nights when we leave Natalie and Brian's, we go back to his house and we talk to his mom for a little while. And then, because he's the best son in the world, he helps her get settled upstairs in bed with her cigarettes, her heating pad, and her paperback book, and her glass of club soda with lime, and her sleeping pill. I wait for him downstairs because Mrs. Sanders is kind of shy, and since her husband died, she likes things done a certain way. Once we are sure she's asleep, we tiptoe up to his room and get into bed. Yes, there are Star Wars sheets. It's a little bit like being a kid again, because we have to whisper since his mom's room is right next to his. Jeremy says she is probably quite aware that we're having sex in his room, but he says there's no need to rub her nose in it, as he put it, since she doesn't approve of sex before marriage. He's always having to remind me not to make any sex noises at all, clamping his hand against my mouth, and many nights, to tell you the truth, it seems more trouble than it's worth. So we simply lie there chastely holding hands while we read our books before we turn in. In the mornings, I have to make sure to leave before she gets up. But it's worth it. He and I haven't hit our sexual stride yet, but we will. He gives wonderful back rubs, and between those and all the soft little kisses, I'm quite turned on by him. And every couple has something to work on. "It'll be so much better when I get my own place," he says. "I just have to approach my mother with that idea very delicately. But I'll do it. And maybe sometime we could get a hotel room, if you want." Late at night, sometimes I lie awake and watch his calm, unlined face as he sleeps. He might have been my snarky best friend back when we were teenagers, but now we've both been a bit humbled by life. HBL, he calls it. And so here we are, milder and gentler versions of our old selves, waiting to see what life will serve up to us. I'm aware that he's the counterpoint to Noah, that he'll never wake me up in the middle of the night to go stand in line for a Lady Gaga concert, that he doesn't even know his car is hopelessly uncool, or that his hairstyle wouldn't meet California standards. He'll never get drunk at a restaurant and start doing the samba around the tables until we get kicked out, as Noah did when we first met. He'll never throw out a case of seltzer water because the one I bought wasn't a brand name, which is also a Noah move. But he wants kids. He loves his mother. He loves me. And he appreciates my mother's meatloaf. And I am watching myself fall in love with him. One day, I'm at work at his office, and I've straightened the magazines and cleaned the little glass window between my cubicle and the waiting room, when he comes sauntering in from the back. It's lunchtime, so there aren't any patients.
"So,"
he says, leaning against the door jamb with his arms folded. He has on his nice, crisp, professional white coat with his name embroidered in maroon script, and he's smiling at me.
"So,"
he says again, in this pseudo-casual tone he uses when things are more important than he wants them to be.
"When do you think you're going to be over this other guy?"
I give a little uncomfortable laugh. "Noah?" He wrinkles his nose.
"Please, don't say his name in the office. This is sacred space."
He looks around, and I see that his eyes are more serious than I've seen them since the day of the condom incident in 12th grade.
"Just level with me here. Before I invest any more of myself in this relationship, you've got to tell me if you're ever going to be really done with him."
I think that in all the ways that count, that I'm already done with him, I say carefully. I am pretty sure I am telling the truth.
"Nope,"
he says.
"It doesn't work that way. You were married to the guy. He did a horrible thing to you. It's only been a few months, and people don't bounce back that fast."
"But I have bounced back. I work extra fast." And then I tell him about Blix, who said some words that steered me toward happiness. A spell that suddenly seems to have come true in a way that none of us were expecting. And here I am. I have arrived at the door of happiness, I say, thanks to some words to the universe that someone chanted for me. For a moment, it occurs to me that I should call her and let her know how it all worked out. But then that thought dissipates. Blix might not see this as the big life she'd promised I'd get. Why disappoint her? I look back at Jeremy, who is shaking his head comically, like he has water in his ears or something.
"Oh, God. Please don't tell me I'm basing my whole future happiness on some fortune teller's notion of the universe."
So I laugh and kiss him right there in his office, right on his smooth, clean-shaven cheek. But then the phone rings, and I have to go back to my desk to answer it. He stands there watching me while I switch around some appointments. I watch him out of the corner of my eye, and I suddenly feel all the doubt dragging on him, and I know that to him I'm the Louisville slugger, and he's the ball. And, well, it pierces my heart, is all, that he doubts me. I take it up with Natalie, my personal enabler and therapist, the next day. "What I want to know is this," I tell her. "Can a person, say, me, actually be ready to move on from a devastating heartbreak so soon? Or am I just kidding myself?"
"Well,"
she says. She is busy changing Amelia's diaper, so she's facing away from me.
"Well, of course you can. Anything can happen where love is concerned. How do you feel?"
I feel like I'm in the right place, where I'm supposed to be." She turns and gives me a big smile.
"Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because that's what I think, too. You and Jeremy have such great chemistry. Brian and I were talking about it last night, as a matter of fact."
"Really?"
"Yeah, you're so easy together. And he's funny, and he's cute, and you seem really, really healthy and happy. Best I've seen you in years."
"I am.
I mean, I think he's great. The only thing is, I just... Well, I'm not nervous and scared around him. You know what I mean? I don't feel all fluttery. It's just comfortable. So, is that what love is? She looks at me like she knows something very wise that I haven't figured out yet. Of course it is. It's such a relief to be with a guy who loves you more than you love him, isn't it? And oh my God, I think, she's exactly spot on. That's what this is. He does love me more than I love him. In fact, he's kind of like a little puppy dog around me, always wanting to please me. So that's what my teeny tiny little sense of hesitation is. He adores me. And although I can make a list of all his wonderful qualities and I know that he's perfect for me, I am not suffering the way I usually do when I'm in love. She's talking away. That's the way it is with mature love, you goose. And it's wonderful. You'll see. It's one less thing you have to worry about. He's not thinking about somebody else or about to realize he doesn't really love you after all. She picks up Amelia, who kicks her fat little legs and flaps her arms. She's so adorable that it's all I can do to keep myself from going over and whisking her right out of Natalie's arms. Wow, I say. You're right. Just one thing. How's the sex? That tells you what you need to know, I always say.
Well, his mother... Oh, right. You've got that prim mom of his in the next room, don't you? Okay, so he's got to get his own place, and then everything will be perfect. And to tell you the truth, sex falls off as the most important thing in the whole world. You'll see.
I look over at my sister, who is possibly the luckiest person in the whole world, managing to celebrate the daily mundanity of marriage without having one iota of regret. She's shown me the texts she and Brian send back and forth, and they're all about who'll pick up the milk, and should they have tacos for dinner, and did she take the car in? Not even one pronouncement about undying love. When we go into the living room, she puts Amelia in her wind-up swing, and we sit on the couch and drink Diet Cokes while the baby falls asleep to the soft whirring of the swing. The air conditioner is a soft hum in the distance, and the refrigerator motor comes on. Adult life seems to be full of the sounds of motors, even lawnmowers. Outside, there is the glistening blue jewel that is their swimming pool. Inside, I watch as a shaft of sunlight flickers across Natalie's thick beige carpet. "Look at her," Natalie whispers. And I turn to the baby, slumped over in the swing, looking like a sack of rice. We both laugh softly, and then I say, "I want one of those. I want to do this, too. You know what would be, like, the greatest thing in the whole world? If you had a baby, too, and we could raise them together, and it would be just like when we were little girls playing house, only now there are real guys here, too. Husbands. That would be the coolest thing," I say. We both start talking about how Jeremy and I could buy a house in this neighborhood once we're married. It's totally not too soon, Natalie says. And then when it feels right, we could start having kids and blah, blah, blah. Something about the guys playing tennis and Natalie and I being together all the time, having barbecue nights and growing old. And I can barely hear her because my blood is pounding in my ears and maybe I am so excited at belonging somewhere. And soon I get up and go take a dip in her pool, and I lie on my back in the crisp, cool water, gazing up at the blue, blue sky with little white clouds that look just like a child painted them. And this, I think, nope, I know, is exactly what happiness feels like.
17. Blix. I am still me. I am still me. I am dying, but I am still who I am. I think I see my mother, feel her hand on my forehead. But then it's not my mother at all. It's Lola here with me. And so is Patrick. I feel his hand holding mine. You have to keep breaking your heart until it opens, I say to him. Rumi said that. Houndy, from somewhere, tells me that Patrick's heart has already broken more than any heart can stand. Shh, I say. So much light is left for you, Patrick. I hear him say, Blix, I have no idea what you're talking about. Do you want some more ice chips? And I do not. Love, I say to him. That is what I'm talking about. Ah, the moon is here again, and the sea. Our blood and the sea have the same pH. Does no one know that? I'll bet Patrick knows. Lola has gone away again. She says it won't be long. He knows so little, poor beautiful Noah. Wants me to have professional people here instead of my friends. Doesn't want to know from death how it can be part of a well-lived life. He sits on my bed next to Patrick and plays the guitar, his hair falling over his gorgeous face. But I don't really hear the music as much as feel it. It's as though my bones are making the noise. Plink, plink, plink. I feel myself say, Houndy. And Noah laughs and says, Houndy? So I know I must have said it aloud. Funny how some sounds exist but don't come into your ears. I love to hear him say that name. Lobsters, I think. Yes, I remember. Houndy brought us lobsters that time I was here. He sings that to the tune of something I almost remember. Patrick says that Houndy was a good man. He wants to know if I can see Houndy right now, and Noah says death doesn't work that way. The light circles around me, and I am outside the old elementary school in my own hometown, and a girl named Barbara Ann is offering me a chocolate. And I smile at her and reach over to take it, and my arm hits something. A person? Houndy? No, Patrick. I'm here, he says. Solid, warm, and I'm walking on the cliff looking at the stars. I might be a star. I used to think we became stars when we died. From stardust to stardust, someone told me. When I told Houndy that, he said, Nope, not stars. I want to become a potato chip. His eyes fill up my whole head. His laughing eyes. Are you coming, my love? Do I have to keep waiting for you? All is love. Just love. Don't be scared. Don't clutch. It's like yoga. Those hard poses, where if you resist, it hurts. It doesn't hurt just to let go. That's Houndy talking now in my head. I can't think of how. What do you drop? What makes letting go happen? The blackness comes over me, but still I don't let go. There's something else I have to do. What do I do after? Noah says. You call the coroner Bunyan Head. This guy really knows nothing, does he? Houndy again. What does he think you're supposed to do? Patrick says he knows what to do. I called my mother, Noah says, close to my ear. How much later is it? His voice is too close, it tickles me. She says I have to call the doctor for you. She insists on it. You need medical care, fast. No, no, no. Patrick, tell him. Patrick says no. Oh, God. Is this going to be my last thought? My last thought on Earth is going to be no? I want to think of something peaceful.